Get home. Half past six, phone rings. It's a client. She's like, ah, I fucking hate this bed, mind. I was like, oh, really? Why? She went, oh, just everything about it. It's just wrong. And I was like, oh, bear in mind the client hadn't paid for it at this point. So, oh, fuck. Right. Okay. Well, can we just go through the points? I'll come to the house. I'll see you in the morning. So I went out to the house, sat down with the clients, talked through the issues with the bed. And as it turned out, I didn't think the list was too bad. So I was like, right, okay, we've talked through stuff. So the next point of resolution is, what would you like me to do? Would you be happy with me to alter the bed, or I'll buy it back off you? So I'll pay you for the cost of the materials. You don't have to pay me for my time, but I'll take the bed and then I will sell the bed on to somebody else. I ended up taking it down, and it was probably 2 days out of my time. And that client has bought 5 or 6 other items off us since then. Every piece that I put out there is a sort of advertisement for what we do. So if a client's saying, yeah, good joiner, didn't like the bed though, would have been happy with this, it's not quite good enough. It has to be spot on every single time. I am Stephen Lamb. My business is Crown and Skull, and I hand make high end bespoke furniture.
Welcome to the Proper Job Podcast, mate. Thanks for that intro. Let's jump straight in and start at the beginning, like any good story. How did you get to where you are today?
So, like a massively long, circuitous route. When I left school, didn't really know what I wanted to do for about a year, so sort of went and did A-levels, but I've never been particularly academic, so I didn't do very well. And then I kind of realised that I wanted to do something creative, and I'd always danced. I'd been a dancer for years, so I went and did a BTEC National Diploma in Performing Arts. Then came out with that at 18 and went straight into professional acting. I went and worked for one of the big Northeast theatre companies on a 10-year contract, doing theatre, doing a Clockwork Orange is what I was doing, and then Animal Farm. So I did that for probably 2 years, sort of never really sat particularly well with us, because I always felt a little bit uncomfortable being watched by everyone. It's a weird thing. So left Newcastle, went out to London, and I ran bars for about 2 years in South London. Learned how to make top cocktails, learned how to sell, how to improve me patter, so to speak. And just kind of had like my university years then. So I was in my early 20s. I hadn't gone to university because I'd been working. So I kind of went to London and did like the things that you're supposed to do at university. I got drunk loads, worked in bars, met loads of cool people, like really immersed myself in South London culture, had a wicked, wicked time. And then I got offered to come back to Newcastle to do a show again that I'd already done, to do Animal Farm a second time round. So I came back up here, went back into that, and then the acting kind of continued on until probably about 2006, 2007. And I kind of just sort of fell out of love with it again. Didn't really know what I wanted to do. I was in the Northeast again. And because all I'd really known was theatre, it was dead easy to get backstage work because I knew everybody up here. So I started being like a 0 hours contract theatre technician. So I would go in, put in sets, fly shows, sweep stages, learned all the technical side of it. And part of that inevitably ended up being repairs on sets. So I started kind of learning how to use power tools and hand tools, how to think on my feet, how to adapt to any kind of situation that is thrown at you, because theatre is really fluid. What works in one venue won't necessarily work in the next venue, won't work in the venue after that. And because a lot of theatre is touring, stuff comes into the venue where you're working that's already been to six other places, and it's already been battered around and put in and out of trucks, and the paintwork will be damaged and the corners will be broken, or something will have been cut to fit somewhere else that needs altering to fit the place where you are. So I just started picking up sort of really basic skills in woodworking and repair work and prop making. And then that kind of naturally progressed more into a focus on building the sets from scratch. So being based in a workshop, taking designs from theatre designers to CAD drawings, then from CAD drawings to making it a reality. So building big bits of set from crashed B-52 bombers, which took up full stages, with working props and gun turrets, to tiny, tiny little things like window frames that light up that you can carry in your hand that look like briefcases. So, like, the range of stuff that you get that I got to build and make was vast. And what I kind of started to recognize was that I sort of enjoyed working with my hands a lot more than I ever thought that I would when I was a teenager. My dad had been a carpenter, and I'd never had any respect for that as a profession. It was something that I never wanted to do. It was something that I had nothing but disdain for, really. I didn't see it as being creative or even that skillful. I thought anyone could do it. And I started to recognize that actually there's more to working with your hands and working with different materials, and in particular for me, working with wood, that is A, very creative, and B, very, very satisfying. And that started to fuel more of an interest in making bits of furniture. And then what happened was, a friend of mine decided she wanted I wanted a dining room table, so we went to Barkland Stonehouse, had a look at dining room tables. She saw this massive oak slab table with dovetail keys in it. I think it was like 4 meters by 1 meter wide, and it was £18,000. So I said, "Yeah." So I said, "Ha, I bet I can do it cheaper for you." And she went, "Really?" And I was like, "Yeah, I reckon I can do it cheaper, and out of a nicer bit of timber, and you'd be happier with it." And she went, "All right, then, you want to set up your business, put your money where your mouth is. You make me a table. I want it delivered before Christmas." And this was in, I don't know, probably the August or the September. And then that was it. That was it. Game on. Game on. I took a little bit of space in my friend's unit, bought a bandsaw, went down to West Sussex, sourced this amazing, two amazing bits of French walnut to make the tabletop out of. It ended up being those exact dimensions, 1 meter wide by, I think it's 4.2 meters long. It's absolutely ginormous. Lovely dovetail keys all the way down it. Yeah, managed to get it done, got it delivered like literally 2 days before Christmas Day, and that was it. That was ball rolling. We put that online, set up the Instagram account, and just started generating interest from that, really. And here we are today, still doing it, still blagging it.
We're all blagging it, mate. Do you need to be good at maths in order to get into woodworking?
As an example, I failed my GCSE maths 5 times, right? And I had to have it. I had to have maths to get on the course that I wanted, the drama course I wanted to do. So when I was alongside my BTEC, I was constantly resitting my GCSE maths exams. I just, when I was at school, I couldn't get it. Don't know why. And I genuinely didn't think I would ever have any need for maths in my life, right? Never. If you'd asked me at school, I'd be like, ah, fuck maths. Maths is for dicks. But the reality is, right, I use maths every single day. And the more I use it, the better I get at it, is the reality. You know, you need a basic understanding of how to use a tape measure. And subtraction and addition is good. A basic understanding of multiplication and division is also well handy. Pythagoras is probably useful if you're messing about with curves a lot. What length of straight timber do I need to make the perfect size curve? You know, so there's, but again, that is basic maths. It's not really high level. And the reality is, in this day and age, Google search will show you how to do that.
Yeah, I agree with that, mate. Google solves most of your problems, pal.
Mate, tell you, it's a godsend.
Oh, yeah. The amount of incriminating stuff someone would find on my Google search history. Anyway, moving on. Do you think being self-employed is for everyone?
No, definitely not. It's definitely not for everyone. And I know lots of people who just aren't designed for self-employment.
In that case, then, what do you think you need in terms of personality traits to be designed for self-employment?
Definitely resilience. 100%. You have to be pretty tough, and you have to be pretty adaptable. So you've got to be resilient and adaptable, right, all at the same time, which is a bit of a weird position to be in, because a lot of people think like being resilient is being stoic and being steadfast and being upright and going, right, I am not moving from this position. And that's not necessarily what being resilient is. You've got to be able to roll with the punches a little bit and adapt to loads and loads of different scenarios, because the reality is there's going to be loads of curveballs.
Yeah, there's not only a difference in terms of character traits, but when you compare a normal 9-to-5 job with self-employment, there's also a different direction, a different roadmap to success.
Best way to describe it, full-time employment is like a really straight path. You know where you're going. I'm going to start here, and if I follow this path, I'm going to get to here, and then there, and then there, and then eventually I might be at the top. Being self-employed is the direct opposite of that. It's being your boss, your own boss, yes, but never quite knowing what that path's going to be. It's definitely not straight. It goes to the right, and then it curves to the left. You come to the end of the path, and there's a forest. And then you have to try and find your way through the forest, which leads you to a river. And then you've got to get across the river, but there's a boat that'll take you over the river. But the boat costs money. So then you pay the money, the boat takes you across the river, and then you realise that actually you need to be back over the other side of the river, and you should have gone left when actually you went right. So you have to backtrack a bit and then go that way. So it's like, it's a constant adventure. Being self-employed is an adventure. And that's what makes it not suitable for everyone. Like,
yeah, I get you, mate. There's no hand-holding when it comes to self-employment.
Nah, not at all. Not at all. And even the other people that are self-employed, they probably won't hold your hand either, because they're not in a position to hold anybody's hand, because they're trying to find that path too. You know, so it can be quite a lonely place to be sometimes when there's not much happening. But for me, it's all I've ever known. It's all I've ever done. Even when I was an actor, I was self-employed. When I was building sets, I was self-employed. Now that I'm making furniture and running my own business, I'm self-employed. So For me, it's just the norm. And actually, I find it really, really difficult working for other people because I've been self-employed for such a long time.
So what is it about that? What is it about working for someone else that just doesn't work for you?
I think there's always a clash in how I would go about doing something. There's always that. And I'm a little bit of a dick, right? So there's always part of my brain that goes, you know better than this, even if I don't. And that makes it, you know what I mean? I do recognize that in myself, though. So what I tend to do is like talk myself into hating the work.
I get that. But you're a hard worker.
Yeah, I don't mind the graft and I don't mind doing as I'm told, but there's just that little thing at the back of my mind that goes, I just have to be quiet, do as I'm told now, get on with the job, when really I would do it completely differently. And so I struggle with that. I do struggle with that.
From my perspective, mate, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I mean, who wants to work for anyone else? I think we've been conditioned by the 9 to 5 because that's what is part of the 9 to 5. You do have a boss and you are told what to do. I think in the real world, or genuine, or perhaps the word I'm looking for is authenticity, is that as humans, are we really supposed to work for other people? And that kind of relates to another question. Although we're perhaps not supposed to work underneath other people and be told what to do, it is important to be inspired. Do you have any role models in your life?
My dad, I mean, sounds really, really weird going back to what I was saying about being a teenager and hating everything that my dad did and all the rest of it. But since I moved into furniture making full time, like, my dad's been a massive, massive help. Just because of his base of knowledge, really. He did his apprenticeship in traditional joinery back in the 50s when he was 14, so like an apprenticeship was an apprenticeship then, and you learned how to do everything the hard way. And he did, he was a joiner undertaker, so he did loads of work, ecclesiastical work, and work at Durham Cathedral and at the university, and have the ability to kind of tap into that traditional joinery knowledge has been absolutely invaluable. Invaluable to me and totally inspirational. Again, going back to what I was saying, I would not work for him. And we definitely do things completely differently because I have had him out with us on jobs before and I've picked his brain on restoration work before. And he's very, very set in his ways, but having that person that if I'm stuck on something, I can ring up and go, Dad, like, what would you have done with this back in the day? How do you think I should approach it? Maybe you've got some ideas that I haven't thought about. Can you come and have a look? Like, would you mind getting your hands on it and having a look and see? Like, that has been a massive, massive help, particularly to what I'm doing now. And it's been, but yeah, that's been kind of invaluable to our relationship as well, really. As a father and son, it's given me a newfound respect for everything that he was doing when we were growing up as kids, which I didn't have before. I didn't understand what he was doing, so I thought carpentry was, you just go and stick a door on some hinges and there you go, it's done, and anyone can do it. And that's what the thick people at school did. Because they couldn't do anything else. And actually, it's not, my dad's probably one of the most undercover creative people that I've ever met. Like, he would never describe himself as an artist or a creative. But underneath that veneer of work and class, like, he's probably one of the most creative people I've ever met. And it took me, like, I don't know, 35 years to realize that. So he's been a mentor.
You mentioned your dad there, mate, and you go back to that time and things were made in the UK and things were made by hand. And I think we're seeing a shift back to those days. There's a multitude of reasons for that. Brexit could be a reason for that. There could be the Cold War that's starting to erupt with China. But also, I think consumer tastes are changing as well.
I mean, the whole Brexit thing is a bit of a, it's a bit of a double-edged sword, and I wouldn't like to clump the idea of Brexit in with what seems to be the new wave of traditional manufacturing and UK manufacturing. I think we were sort of heading in that direction anyway, and have been probably for the last, I don't know, 10 years maybe. There's certainly been a massive upsurge in the interest in traditional crafts and traditional manufacturing, because the reality is we were losing it. As a nation, we've lost pretty much all of our heavy industry. The steel industry was sort of the last bastion of that, really. But over the last 10 years, you've seen more and more closures of steelworks, particularly in the northeast, in Middlesbrough, in that area. Prior to that, it was shipbuilding. That was our big manufacturing base in this region, coal mining. Other areas of the country, it was obviously car manufacturing, the likes of Rover and Jaguar and Land Rover and Rolls-Royce and Bentley and all of these companies that were manufacturing in the UK. Vauxhall, I think Vauxhall are probably the only one that still do now. I think with the demise of all of that in the 80s and Thatcherism and that idea of privatisation of public services, as opposed to the focus on industry and then bringing manufacturing in with, you know, the Japanese companies like Nissan and Komatsu, there was a real loss of skill within probably two or three generations of young people. You know, the onus was on pushing people towards university and education. And, you know, if you want to make anything in your life, you've got to go into business. You've got to be an investment banker. You have to be a lawyer. Doctors are the way to go. You know, if you want to make an infinite amount of money, tech, move into tech.
What about your industry, Steve? What about woodworking? Are we seeing a resurgence there?
Within my industry, there's certainly a couple of companies that have had resurgences, I would have thought, due to the interest in bespoke furniture. Like, before, you kind of had to really look for it. You know, if you wanted a piece of high-end furniture making, you know, you would have to Google it, and then there was probably, I don't know, maybe 20 companies in the country that were doing it. Some of them will have websites, some of them don't have websites. Some of them you have to ring up. Some of them will be booked up for 5 or 6 years in advance, because it's people like me, it's one man in his workshop that gets work, word of mouth mainly, who is knocking out, you know, walnut dressing tables that are worth 25-30 grand, you know, if not more. You know, there's a couple of manufacturers who certainly deal with the 1%, the people who are having their mansions built or want their stately homes, or the furniture in their stately homes, reworking or restoring. Again, it's a very, very niche market, that. Like, very, very niche market.
Yeah, I think I can see that industry growing. And I think it's up to the people. They need to be using local businesses. It's going to cost a little bit more, but it's helping out the whole ecosystem of local trade and local jobs. Given this is my first interview and I don't really know what I'm doing yet, let's find out a little bit more about you. Maybe people want to know about that. So how would your mates describe you, Steve?
That's a good one. Loyal. Definitely. Compassionate. Hardworking.
What makes you get up in the morning? What motivates you?
Definitely the work. Having the ability to to take an idea and to turn it into something tangible and real that you can touch and feel and use and admire. That's a massive moat. You know, that's the passion. The passion isn't the skills. The skills are amazing to learn, but the passion is being able to take those skills and apply them and go to a client. That thing that you wanted, I've done it. It's here. There you go. Do you love it? Yes, you do. Perfect. Perfect.
So it's having the ability of being able to turn an idea in your head into a physical object.
Yeah, absolutely.
How's that handover process for customers? You said you have these ideas and you make them into physical objects. Well, I said that. But what is it like on the day, on handover day? Once you've made that piece of furniture and the customer's going to come in to view it and give their opinion, how does that go down, man?
Like delivery day, I'm always fucking high as a kite. Always. Because you do, like, no matter what your relationship's like with your customers, you can send them photographs, you know, you can describe what you're going to do, you can show them drawings, you can show them pictures of stuff that it might be like. Like, until they see it, you never really know. You never really know. And actually, I kind of judge a lot of the stuff that I make, I don't judge it on how people react when they see it. I'm very tactile. So I kind of define the success of a piece of furniture if a client touches it, right? And I know it sounds really weird, but a lot of the stuff I make is stuff that I want to touch. So if I deliver a piece and I put it where it needs to go and I go and a client goes up and rubs their hand across the top of it or they touch the drawers, that's a win for me. That's when I go, right.
Yeah, big sigh of relief.
Yeah, I did it. Some stuff like you can't wait to get out the door. Some of it I'm like, whew, this has been, you know, if it's been particularly challenging or you get into a piece and halfway through, because this does happen. This is the other thing about being artistic or creative is like sometimes you just hit a wall with something. So you'll be halfway through a piece and you know how it's going to look and you just kind of hit this wall where you've got no inspiration and no enthusiasm for it because you've spent 2 weeks just fucking processing stock, just like getting everything ready and hand planing stuff down and dimensioning things up and cutting stuff to length. And by the time you come to put it together, you can't see the wood for the trees, so to speak.
Great pun. I relate to that. How do you get yourself motivated again? What advice do you have?
I usually have a couple of like tiny personal projects, stuff that I want to do that's not very time consuming, that I can just jump on something. So like at the minute I've had a guitar body, a Telecaster guitar body that I've been working on for a friend for like, he's in no rush for it. So we've been faffing about with it for like 6 months. So if I'm working on a customer's piece and I hit the wall and I'm like, right, I can't think about what I'm going to do, I'll put that out of the way for a day and go and do something else. Think about something else, work on something else, sharpen my tools. You know, any kind of other task where you can kind of mentally switch off. So actually sharpening the tools is a really good one because it's really monotonous. It's really boring and it's quite time consuming. So what I find is, I'll strip all the blades out of my planes, lay them all out, break everything down, get out the sharpener, mark up all the edges, and I can quite easily spend 4 hours just putting the right level of sharpness back on everything, putting everything back together. And normally, because you can zone out, it just kind of creates that space in your brain. You know, if you sleep on a problem, usually in the morning, you've come up with a solution because your brain's just had time to not think about it and not be obsessed with that situation and that or that job for enough time to sort of refocus, remotivate yourself, come back in, look at it from a different angle and go, oh, right, okay, I'm getting to the interesting bit now so I can look forward to that. So it's a little bit about, you know, it's kind of playing mind games with yourself a little bit. You've got to trick yourself into being motivated.
I think tricking yourself is a great skill to have. You know, overcoming what your brain's telling you to do and then doing the opposite. That relates to kind of overcoming fears. And on that note then, what is your biggest fear?
Oh, myself. I think my biggest problem has always been me getting in my own way. So, for example, I'm trying to think of a good example of this. Like, when I started my acting career, I kind of was dead successful straight out the gate. So I was in a position where 99.9% of people who go into that profession, they'll never get near where I was at the beginning of their career. So I came straight out of college, straight into a professional theatre company, doing a professional job, unheard of, getting paid proper wages, equity minimum, which is the union. You know, most people have to come out of college, go to drama school, and then they might get an agent and they might like pick around for a few years doing bits and pieces of work here and there until they start like developing a reputation. And I kind of really didn't have to do that. So I kind of didn't have that sort of work ethic that you need to sort of drive you forward. So over the duration of my career, I didn't really sort of appreciate what the position I was in. I did like 5 or 6 shows in Newcastle over the duration of like a 5-year period, 6-year period with the break in London. Then I came back and then got offered feature film. So I'd done bits and pieces of TV, got offered to play a monster in The Descent, or the film that would become The Descent, which is Neil Marshall's like second film, biggest budget film at the time. He'd just done Dog Soldiers. So like, again, massive opportunity, a huge opportunity, the kind of opportunity people dream of, absolutely dream of. And at that time, I was sort of already kind of talking myself out of being a successful actor, is what I was doing. I was going, maybe this isn't for you. Maybe you don't fit in here. Maybe, just maybe, you don't deserve this. You haven't really worked hard for it. Maybe there's other people out there who are working harder who should be in the position that you're in. And that that constantly been going on in the back of my mind, sort of since I started, really. And it's a funny industry. I don't think I never found it particularly rewarding. I thought when I was younger that I would enjoy the attention. And as it turns out, I didn't really enjoy the attention at all. I've always been more of an undercover motherfucker. don't like people watching us. So that was the point where really what we should have been doing is should have been doubling down. Like, if that was going to be my career decision, that was the point where I was going to double down and go, listen, I've just done this film, it's massively successful, like I am hot property. Like, if you want to employ me, look at my CV, it's 2 pages long of amazing, amazing things. I've worked with amazing people and amazing directors and amazing theatre companies, and I've done this wicked film and I've done good TV. Like, it's my time now to be famous. It's my time. And instead, I went, see you later, I'm off, bye now. I'm going to go and be his technician. So I've always had this thing sort of built into as well, get to a point of potentially taking something to the next level, potentially making a real genuine, or what other people, what other people would perceive as being the next step to definite success and a definite career. And at that point, I've always gone, nah, you're all right. You're all right. I don't like that. And something about it has always made us feel really, really uncomfortable. And in that respect, I've always felt like I've got in my own way. And if I'm not careful, you know, we talk a lot about mental health these days, like, which is something that people have only just started discussing properly over the last 5 years. You know, but we all have these traits in us where we're very good at self-sabotaging. You know, and if you've got any kind of background in those traits anyway, it can send you down a path of like real darkness if you're not careful. And I think certainly in my 20s, like, I think I probably counteracted that a little bit by thinking I was mint by ego. I think in your 20s, your ego sort of balances that out a little bit. So you go, no, like, I am the dog's bollocks. But then when you start realizing, you know, that maybe you're not. Maybe you're not, and maybe you don't need the attention that you've got, and maybe you start feeling, certainly for me, I started feeling like I didn't deserve it. And that took us down like a huge, like, real road of discovery about what it was I thought about myself, really, behind that image of the actor on stage and, you know, this successful person. And because underneath it, actually, I was quite empty, and I always felt empty. I always felt like, nah, that's not me. It's not me. I'm lucky, and I should roll with it, you know, but I'm not happy with it. And the less happy you are, the more you get in your own way, 100%. Like, you will quite happily put actual fucking barriers in your own way. And that's sort of what I started doing. Like, mid-20s to late-20s, coming out of theatre, coming out of acting, going into what I, in my 20s, looked at as menial work, like lifting stuff around, unloading trucks. Like, I had to really sort of torture myself a little bit to counteract the success that I had. So that was like another barrier that I put in my way, because I thought, oh, well, you've done that now. That was your thing. Now you have to be at the bottom, and you have to work at the bottom, and you have to not be smart and not want anything and not strive for anything, not have any goals. And then it sort of wasn't until I found it, like, making stuff was my actual passion, that I started going, all right, okay, I'm feeling more content in myself. But still, on the path to starting this business, I've put 1,001, like, there's 1,001 ways I've tried to self-sabotage, like, loads, from I don't have any excuses, I don't have any transferable skills, there's loads of other people out there who are much, much better than me. Why would anybody want to buy my work? Why would anybody want to commission me to build furniture for them when they could go and get it from somebody else for the same price, and they're already established, they've already put the work in, they've already built their career. There was loads and loads of just little negative mental barriers that I continuously put in my way. Like, along with, and that actually goes along, so if I'm saying from like late 20s, probably to my early 40s, late 30s, early 40s, like, even constantly putting barriers in my way so I didn't have to find another job, even though I wasn't doing this, but going, well, I'll never get a job in a factory because I didn't do very well. I didn't do very well at school, and like, because I haven't learned anything, I'll never be any good at it. So I can't go and work for Nissan because I've never worked on a factory line before. That's an excuse to not get a proper job. Like, there's no point in me applying for work because the only thing I'm qualified to do is push trolleys around the supermarket in Tesco's. The only thing I'm qualified to do is work behind a bar, wait on tables. So constantly, like, going, just constantly trying to stop myself from getting anywhere. And that worked up to a point until eventually you do run out of excuses and you go, well, you know, I'm either going to do this or I'm not going to do it. And other people pointing us in that direction helped loads. My wife going, well, if you don't fucking do something, you know, we're going to be poor forever. you know, you don't want to be that person who's working for other people and making them money, do you? You don't like doing that. You don't want to go and work in a supermarket. So come on, finger out your ass, work for yourself. Some of my clients going, showing me that they had trust in us in the first place to go, oh, we've seen this, we like this, here's something else. And slowly but surely, and again, age is a massive thing, I think. I've learned to just ignore those voices, that little bit of self-doubt, to recognise when I'm trying to like really fuck myself up by, and it's usually when I'm saying no to things. So it's usually like if in the back of my head I can hear the voice going, just say no to that because you're not going to be able to do it. Just say no. Just say no. And then I go, oh, ha, 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 fucking caught you. I'm not going to say no. That's a yes. And that helps. Like, again, it's a lot of it's tricking yourself. But my worst fear is being in that position again where I can see myself standing in my own way, stopping the business from progressing, stopping me from delivering on a client's expectations, and not being able to do something about it. Not being able to go, ah, that's the no, man. You get out the fucking way. It's a yes. We're going to do it.
Amazing insight, Steve. Love that. Great advice. Before we wrap up, mate, you got any advice for people? Any career advice? I know this isn't exactly a career advice service, but yeah, anything to finish the interview off?
I mean, if anything, you know, again, I would just reiterate that thing of just not being frightened of yourself and not being frightened of trying loads and loads of stuff and failing. I think if somebody had said that to me when I was much, much younger, and I'm guessing to you as well, you know, what, you wouldn't put so much pressure on yourself. You know, and that leads to, it ties you up in knots. It really does. It's responsible, I think, for so much conflict within yourself. It causes all kinds of problems, man. That's what tips you over the edge, is that questioning and lack of confidence and fear. Like, it's such an important thing. It took me such a long time. If it was like, if I think about it, 10 years of an acting career, 10 years of a theatre career, to go, oh, do you know what? I'm not fucking frightened anymore. I'm not. I've survived without cash. Fuck it, it doesn't matter. Because you can always find work and you can always find money to survive. Like, the trick is not being frightened of it. Another good bit of advice is never, don't be too good for anything. Like, if you're trying to survive, don't think that you're too good to mop a fucking floor, or sell a burger at McDonald's, or check out people's groceries at a supermarket, or push trolleys around a car park. Like, nobody is...
I think you need that. I think you need to do those shit jobs at the start of your life. Pot washing. Waiter, bar, you know, those kind of, like, just get in there.
Yeah, crack on and do them, because through doing those jobs, you'll, even though it's classed as menial work, it's not menial. What it's teaching you is an invaluable lesson about work ethic, because if you can do the jobs that you hate and tolerate it, well, by the time you actually do find the thing that you want to do, your work ethic will be so good that you'll be able to apply that straight away and maintain the level of discipline that you will need, particularly if you're working by yourself and you're self-employed. That's an invaluable thing. And for those times, like when there's not work coming in, like, it's a great thing to have in the back of your head that, do you know what, I don't fucking care if I go and drive like a taxi for 2 months because I've got no work. I don't mind washing dishes. I don't mind working behind a bar for minimum wage just because just for that survival money, and I can tolerate it and live with it and know I can do it and not feel bad about myself doing it, because ultimately that's going to feed into what I'm going to do and what I'm passionate about. I don't think people tell anyone nobody tells you that. Everybody now goes, you should just focus on that one thing. Like the biggest example for me is always, you want to work in theatre, or you want to be on stage, or you want to be a singer, get used to fucking washing dishes. Get used to doing all of the shit work, because you're going to be doing that 99.9% more of the time than you're going to be on stage. Like, you're talking, there's that 1% of people who are famous and make it. But those menial jobs, get your work ethic in place for when the right opportunity comes along, you can step into it and you already know how to work hard. You already know. Like, if you've got your own business and it's not doing so well, not being demoralised by having to step back and take on other work is a massive advantage. If you get used to that beforehand, before you're established, while you're finding the thing that you're passionate about, it's going to set you up really, really well for the future. Really, really well. Because you'll always be able to rely on that resilience. And knowing that you're not bothered about working hard for very little money to get to where you need to be again. Massively important. Does that make sense?
That's great advice, mate.
And it's stuff like that that the standard careers of advice doesn't tell you. That's the kind of thing that you don't get in an Instagram meme. You know, there's no influencer telling you about any of the bullshit that they might have had to do to get to that position that they're in now with that many followers. In the photograph, you know, of that really beautiful girl in full makeup with a bikini on, photoshopped and all of it, you know, you don't see her pulling a thong out of her ass all of the time in the background, and the uncomfortable position that she's got to sit in for 4 hours, you know, the amount of yoga that she has to do, or the gym work that she has to do to maintain that, you know, and the starving, you see, you know, all of that stuff behind that Instagram image, you don't see that. That image is bullshit. It's a lie and it's a veneer. I do it myself with my photographs. They're set up. 9 times out of 10, that wood shaving is in that place because I've put it there. Because the reality is, if you saw the fact that actually, you know, my hands are constantly covered in dirt. I'm constantly dusty. There's stuff all over the fucking workshop, all of the time. Like, in order for me to set up a workshop photograph, it's like 4 hours of cleaning. Like, I'm at the point now, particularly with social media, where I can't be arsed with it. Like, you'll have noticed, I don't really post that much anymore because I can't be arsed. Can't be arsed with the aggro of setting up with a photograph when, actually, it's much more productive for me to take that time and finish making what I'm supposed to be making.
Talking of finishing off what you're making, mate, we're done.
Perfect.
Thank you very much for your time today, mate.
Anytime, Max.
Amazing job, bro. Thank you.
Thanks, man.